You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll look at tensions between bikes and cars when it comes to sharing the road. First, Wisconsin police officers are joining the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to tackle drunk driving. The Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign started last Friday and will run through Labor Day weekend. Wisconsin has seen higher than average rates of drunk driving. The CDC reported that as of 2012, 3.1% of adults reported driving after drinking too much, and that's compared to the 1.9% national average. And joining us now to talk more about that campaign and efforts to halt drunk driving is Dane County Sheriff Dave Mahoney. Sheriff Mahoney, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. It's quite an honor to join you.
Well, why is this particular program that Wisconsin is a part of, why is it being launched at this time of year, a couple of weeks before Labor Day weekend it starts?
You know, as we're entering the Labor Day holiday and really the last chance to get out on vacations and exercise the end of summer before school begins, people are out on our roads even more and celebrating the end of summer. And so the Sheriff's Office has taken advantage of many of the federal and state motor vehicle grants, and one of those is Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. Last year, there were 555 deaths on Wisconsin highways. 190 of those people were killed and over 2,900 injured as a result of drunk driving-related crashes. We take traffic safety very seriously here in Dane County, and as a result, we exercise on a regular basis speed, alcohol, and seat belts as the three primary causes of death on our highways, where we really want zero in Wisconsin, meaning we want zero deaths as a result of common sense vehicle use.
Is there a sense that Labor Day weekend is one of those flashpoints when there may be more injuries and fatalities on the roads?
Well, more and more people are on the road, and as a result, we expect that there will be more motor vehicle crashes. And because of the culture of drinking in Wisconsin, unfortunately, we expect it to impact alcohol-related crashes as well.
Well, tell us about this program that Wisconsin is joining, a national program, Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. What kind of enforcement or presence will that have when it kicks in, which is pretty much starting right now?
Well, as you mentioned, this task force began on August 19th, and it will go through September 5th. We'll have a number of deputies out on our roadways. Matter of fact, August 25th, 26th, and 27th are our next targeted periods when we will look at high traffic areas at different times of the day, and we will then assign anywhere from a half a dozen to a dozen traffic officers, traffic deputies out on those roadways looking for drunk drivers.
And what shape does that partnership have? It's Wisconsin is part of it, and it's also this national effort. How is it coordinated?
Well, it's coordinated through the Federal Motor Vehicle Department and then handed down to each one of the states. As a result of our strong commitment to traffic safety, we've been given the tax dollars to put more deputies on our roads to make our roads safer. This began about 10 years ago when I began my term as sheriff. We saw a spike in traffic deaths on Dane County highways. And as a result of these task forces and grant opportunities, we've actually dropped our traffic fatality and major injury numbers here in our county.
So there's evidence that efforts like this one, that they work, that they deliver results.
They do. As I mentioned, zero in Wisconsin is our target. It may be a lofty goal, but every year we're seeing a dramatic decrease in motor vehicle-related fatalities and major injuries. And I think that that's because, first, awareness, public education, followed by strict enforcement.
Okay, so I'm curious about that. You said there's been a decrease. I have a quote here from the director of the Wisconsin DOT Bureau of Transportation Safety saying that drunk driving, maybe not the injuries or fatalities, but that drunk driving itself has grown by 17% from 2014 to 2015.
And, you know, part of that, I believe, is related to binge drinking and not pacing oneself. And there really is no excuse, because as you leave for the evening or leave for the weekend, and in anticipating a celebratory weekend, plan ahead and have a designated driver. Identify somebody who won't be consuming alcohol, who can take responsibility of that vehicle. And if not, if you're in an urban area like Madison, take advantage of mass transit. If you find yourself buzzed at the end of the night and you feel that you can't safely operate that vehicle, take mass transit, take a cab, call for a ride. And the vast majority of taverns in Wisconsin are subscribers to this, to the Safe Rider program. So if you're drinking at a tavern, at a supper club, they'll provide a free ride home. So there's really no excuse today to get behind the wheel of a vehicle while under the influence.
We're talking with Dave Mahoney right now, Dane County Sheriff, and we're talking about Wisconsin law enforcement joining up with a nationwide campaign to stop drunk driving, and it's called Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. And in this this approach, there is a zero tolerance aspect to us. Can you explain how that works?
There is a zero tolerance. If a deputy stops you on the road and you appear to be under the influence of alcohol, they'll run you through a battery of tests. And if you fail those tests, you'll be arrested for drunk driving in addition to operating a vehicle with a blood alcohol level above 0.08, which is the legal limit. There's an automatic revocation of your driver's license and a very hefty fine followed by an impact to your insurance. So it's much greater than just the financial cost. There's that potential of losing your life or being the result of somebody else losing their life because of your bad decision making.
So looking again at overarching trends in Wisconsin, we've seen drunk driving levels going up. You're saying you're seeing, it sounds like, injuries and fatalities going down. But what is your sense overall? So those two don't quite square with each other. How are we doing at keeping the roads and highways safer? And I'm also thinking about how the speed limit just went up 10 miles per hour to 75. I wonder how that's impacting things. What is your sense so far?
Well, I think public awareness and bringing the issues to light so that people understand what's occurring and not letting it fester, if you will, followed by strict enforcement. We talked about a zero tolerance. In Wisconsin, if you drive drunk, you will be arrested. It's that simple, because it's our responsibility to maintain safety on our roads, to save your life, even if you don't use good decision-making, and to save the life of others who may be on that roadway as well.
And there was, I understand, an app developed that can help people who are, maybe they're out, they've had a couple drinks, they're not sure if they want to drive or if they're safe to drive. Can you tell us more about this app and how it works?
Yeah, matter of fact, as I mentioned, Zero in Wisconsin, that app is Zero in Wisconsin.
Zero in Wisconsin.
ZeroInWisconsin.gov. And it provides resources on the motor vehicle website that would be available for an individual to get a safe ride home, to look for alternatives to getting behind the wheel, which is really our objective. That, you know, plan ahead first. If you find yourself in a situation where you may be intoxicated and you didn't plan ahead, well, use the right decisions. Take mass transit if you're in an urban area. Call for a ride, take a cab, or ask the tavern owner for a free ride home.
And are people taking that advice? Are they using this app and thinking ahead?
The evidence is that the app is being used and people are using good common sense. But on the flip side, there's still people who get behind the wheel of a car driving drunk every day, and it needs to come to an end.
What if you're not a drinker yourself, but you happen to be on the road on Saturday night at 11 o'clock or maybe at bar time? Are there any pieces of advice you have for defensive driving?
Always drive for that other person on the road and be aware of your surroundings. If you happen to be traveling on the road and you see a vehicle that you believe the operator may be under the influence, let them pass you, get out of your way. But we also need you to call 911 and immediately notify law enforcement of a potential drunk driver so that we can help save their life and save the lives of those who may be on the road.
Sheriff Mahoney, thank you so much for coming up to the studio today.
Thank you very much. It's always an honor to join you.
That was Sheriff Dave Mahoney from Dane County joining us there to talk about the Wisconsin law enforcement effort joining up with a nationwide campaign to stop drunk driving. It's called Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. After Wisconsin Life, which is coming up next, most of us have had a difficult job or two, and we want to hear from you about your most miserable job, what you had to endure to make ends meet. Maybe you did have a tough job, but you loved it anyway. Well, we want to hear your memories about your worst job ever. Call in and you can share at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be taking your calls on that shortly, but first it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Few jobs were as miserable and hot as work in a 19th century iron mill, especially in the summer. We may be sweating now, but historian John Gerda tells us about the workers who labored in unimaginable conditions.
All winter we long for this. Green grass, open windows, and heat. Blessed heat. Now that it's here, many of us spend our days moving between air-conditioned homes and air-conditioned offices in air-conditioned cars. Our ancestors had no such options, especially if they wore blue collars. Some workplaces were practically hell on earth in summer, and Milwaukee's most infernal employer must have been the Bayview Iron Mill. Opened in 1868, the mill dominated the South Lakefront. Within a decade, it was the second largest source of railroad rails in America, and Milwaukee's largest employer by a wide margin. It was not work for the delicate. In 1881, the Milwaukee Sentinel sent a reporter down to the mill during a heat wave. What he found there would have horrified any modern health and safety inspector. Puddlers, the skilled workers who tended the blast furnaces, routinely endured temperatures above 160 degrees. They spent 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, producing cauldrons of liquid iron. Workers down the line fared no better. Some rolled red-hot ingots fresh from the furnace into rails, and others stacked them while they were still glowing. There were no electric fans because there was no electricity. The furnace men typically worked bare-chested with Turkish towels wrapped around their necks to soak up some of the sweat. Every worker downed 2 to 3 buckets of a concoction called oatmeal water during his shift, usually laced with lemon juice. The skilled workers earned $5 a day and not one dime in fringe benefits. Unskilled workers took home a little over a dollar for their 12-hour days. Safely back in his office, the Sentinel correspondent could afford to wax philosophical. No one is to blame for it all, he wrote. Railways must be constructed. The men are satisfied with their pay and must be satisfied with the weather. The mill hands were a good deal less satisfied than the reporter suggested. The skilled workers organized a union called the Sons of Vulcan, and in 1873, 9 heaters left their jobs to protest excessive temperatures. They were promptly fired, a move that stirred the union to call a walkout of 900 employees. Production ground to a halt. One of the discharged workers, in a triumph of understatement, said the position of a heater is not an envious one. In cold weather, the perspiration steams from them, and in hot weather with no breeze, it is scarcely bearable. The sweat kept pouring until 1929, when the mill closed for good. And the site is now largely green space at the south end of the Dan Hone Bridge. Today, only the ghosts remain. Next time the mercury climbs past 80, step out of your air-conditioned cocoon for a moment and raise a glass of oatmeal water to the mill hands of 1881. They were men of iron, wrote the Milwaukee Sentinel, who become red hot and yet do not melt.
John Gerda is an award-winning historian and the author of many books, including Milwaukee, City of Neighborhoods. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Although it's a safe bet that you haven't had to work in a 19th century iron mill for $5 a day, drinking oatmeal water, most of us have had a job or two that sticks out as being really, really awful in a different way. And we'd like to hear from you now. Have you had a horrible job that you just had to do to pay the bills? What was that worst job ever? Or maybe you did have a difficult job. Maybe you loved it anyway. Call in now and share your worst job experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can share on the Central Time Facebook page.
Hello, Peter. What's happening? I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. So if you could be here around 9, that would be great. Okay? Oh, and I almost forgot. I'm also going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday, too. Okay? We lost some people this week, and we need to sort of play catch-up. Thanks.
A clip from the classic movie about hating your job, Office Space. And Amanda Magnus, one of our producers, has had a bit of her own experience with hating a job. Not Central Time,
no,
I'm hoping.
Not Central Time.
What is your worst job experience, Amanda?
So I worked at a large chain restaurant whose name shall not be mentioned when I was living in New York City. So I was working multiple jobs at the time, and it was underground. It was in a well-known train station. There was no natural light, and it was just a terrible, terrible place to work. It was hot all the time. There wasn't very much air conditioning. People were really short with you because they were trying to wait for their train and leave right away. I never made much money, and I also hated every second of that job.
Well, it drove you to greet our pastors to Central Time.
It did. It did. It was awful. I mean, even from the beginning when I was training for that position, it was a two-floor restaurant that we were training at, not the one in the train station. The kitchen was in the basement, and a lot of diners were sitting on the first or second floor. There was no elevator. And so I was carrying these giant heavy trays up multiple flights of stairs to patrons, passengers, I guess, if they were in the train station. Also, a lot of times, because this was a train restaurant, the prices were way higher than they were, than customers were used to. So they would come in expecting, oh, I'm used to this place. I'm used to what the price might be. And then surprise, it was way more expensive, but it was just the same low quality food. So people were often very unhappy with what was going on.
I had that similar experience of working in a multi-level restaurant as a server and having to schlep up and down with these giant trays. I suppose it was, you know, good cardio.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. It's a good workout, but it's very dangerous.
Well, let's take our first caller on this one. We've got Yuki on the line in Milwaukee. Yuki, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share about your worst job?
I'm in my 40s now, but when I was probably in my 20s, I had a boyfriend who worked at a meat processing plant. And I got me a job there, and I ended up working on, it's called the kill floor, where the beef comes in, and it's, I worked on that line, and it was just a little ways down the line, and my job was a kidney popper.
What is a kidney popper?
When they, it sounds so gruesome, they cut the animal down the middle, and the kidney is inside there, and it was my job to remove the kidney and not pop it. But I guess they gave it the name of kidney popper because sometimes you would pop the kidney.
Oh, boy.
And, yeah.
That sounds like a memorable job. I mean, I'm sure someone, I mean, that's the thing about these jobs. They're difficult, but someone does these jobs. I want to honor the jobs. But on the other hand, I think we can all agree some of these are pretty tough. Yuki, thank you so much for sharing your worst job ever as a kidney popper in a meat processing plant. What is your worst job ever? 800-642-1234.
We're going to take a call next from Teresa in Appleton. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Yeah, I'm here.
What was your worst job?
I worked at a major pizza frozen pizza manufacturing company.
And what did you hate about that job, Teresa?
It wasn't the job itself. It was the people. It's you have these supervisors that stand around and just leer at you with their hands in their pockets of their lab coats, and you're struggling to keep up with a line that makes 170-some pizzas a minute.
All right. So lots of times coworkers are the reasons that jobs can be really rough. And it sounds like that was the case for Teresa with her pizza manufacturing job there. Let's take another call here. Dale is with us in River Falls. Hi, Dale.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What is your worst job?
Good. I worked at a paper mill during the summers while I was going to college. And by and large, I really enjoyed the work. However, there was one time a summer where our job was to climb into a machine that was called lovingly Jaws, and our job was to replace blades that were 6 feet tall, and there were probably about 50 of them, and they were designed to basically chip up an entire tree as soon as they hit those blades.
Wow. So did anyone ever get hurt doing that?
Not that I know of.
Oh. Well,
it's a bit daunting.
It sounds more than a bit daunting. Dale, thank you for sharing that one with us. Appreciate it. For me, my worst job was a mall job. I worked at a food store in the mall, and my job a lot of the time was to stand there and offer people samples of beef log,
what it was called.
And then they got to choose whether it was sweet and spicy mustard or a different mustard, and it was kind of tasty. But people would come back more than once, and you weren't supposed to let them come back, so you kind of had to bust them, too.
You had to police the food samples.
You did, yeah.
That's a dream killer of a job.
And the smell you went home with was not ideal, but there were some other perks there. I liked some of the other aspects of the job, but it's fun to look back. It makes for good stories.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for the calls. And remember, you can keep the conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what your worst job was. Maybe it was in the summertime, maybe at a different time in your life. It's fun to share. We'd love to hear what you have to say. Coming up, we'll find out about a renewed push for vulnerable users legislation after a bicyclist was hit and killed near the town of Oregon. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
One of these days I'm going to blow my top, and that sucker, he's going to pay. Lord, I can't wait to see their faces when I get the nerve to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, it's Reveal. Tonight, all over the American wilds, bobcats are hunted for their beautiful pelts, often with controversial equipment. Reveal hears from people trapping and selling the animals, as well as animal rights activists who want the practice banned. That's tonight at 7 on Reveal. First, a bicyclist, a husband and a father of two children, one of them still on the way, was killed earlier this month near the town of Oregon. The driver who struck and killed the cyclist left the scene and will be facing criminal charges. That recent death, along with a bicyclist who was killed earlier in the summer along Highway 14, is causing some advocates to be angry. Dave Cheslevich, executive director of the Wisconsin Bike Federation, has been blogging about the rights of cyclists on the road, and our next guest says tensions between cars and bikes can run high. Mike Ivey joins us now. He's an avid cyclist himself, as well as a longtime journalist and current talk radio host and freelance writer. He wrote about the recent death of that Dane County cyclist and the aftermath for Madison Magazine. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about what happened when this cyclist near Oregon was struck and killed by a truck earlier this month?
Well, it was a guy who was out training for a triathlon about 6:30 in the morning, a fairly well-bicycled town road east of Oregon, and he was struck from behind, apparently, by a guy driving a truck who did not stop at the scene. And someone later came out and found the guy dead, and now the driver is going to face some fairly serious charges, but just for the hit and run. If he had stayed at the scene, he likely would have probably maybe just gotten a traffic ticket. And I think that's one of the things that bicycling advocates and the Wisconsin Bike Fed is trying to push. There really is no charge that can be added on to a bicycle crash, short of trying to charge someone with negligent homicide, which is a felony and a very difficult thing to prove. They're pushing for something called a vulnerable users law. About 9 other states have a vulnerable users law. It more or less gives district attorneys some leeway between charging a driver with homicide and just a basic traffic ticket. It would add additional fines, and it would also be charged as a misdemeanor. Just one quick example here. There's a woman a couple of years ago outside of Menasha. She fell asleep at the wheel and then hit a guy who was waiting on his bike at a stop sign, and she got a $248 fine was all that happened to her. And she clearly had been at fault and fallen asleep. So I think, you know, any time a bicyclist is killed or badly injured, it really sends shockwaves through the biking community, because a lot of these people know each other. It's a fairly close-knit community. And now with social media, the minute there's an accident, it goes out to everybody. So, there's so many more people riding bikes now, and we have more cars on the road. So it's not a new thing that there's been tension between bicyclists and drivers, but anytime there's an accident like this, it really brings things to the forefront.
Right. So what kind of response did this most recent guest near the town of Oregon, this most recent death, get from cycling advocates?
Well, I mean, if you read Dave Cheslevich's blog, he more or less had said he hopes this guy is convicted and rots in jail was really the way he had worded it. It did create a lot of anger. I think if you look at the driving record of the driver, he'd had some previous brushes with the law. And he said at a time he thought he had hit a deer, and I think that comment really angered a lot of people, because, I mean, let's face it, when you're on a bicycle and you hit by a car, an egg being dropped, you know, from 10 stories, you're going to come out a loser every time, and those driving a car does come with rights. Or responsibilities to be aware of what's out there. So I know bicyclists often ride in fear. As I wrote in my column for Madison Magazine, I've been riding bikes almost for half a century now. I'm sort of ashamed to admit, but I think things are a lot better than they used to be. I think most drivers tend to be more aware. I think bicyclists, as a general rule, are know that riding courteously and trying to get along with people, using hand signals, for example, where appropriate, trying to make eye contact at stop signs, all those things go a long way toward improving the reputation of bicyclists.
It's interesting, though, this article of yours in Madison Magazine, reading the comments, people are still kind of upset of it, and they're coming from different perspectives there, from the perspective of drivers and from the perspective of bicyclists. And some of the criticism there about your piece, some people saying, well, bicyclists should be paying more to use these roads. They don't share the same cost burden that drivers face, so maybe they shouldn't have the same rights. And you also made a point in your piece about how you, as a serious cyclist, someone like you, you don't want to do a full stop at a stop sign. You don't want to put a foot down anyway. And people said, well, they should put a foot down. So there are these simmering tensions.
Yeah, exactly. I make the comparison that coming to a complete stop at a stop sign, especially if no one's there, would be akin to stopping your car, turning off the engine, getting out and getting back in and turning your engine on again. With a bike, it's momentum. It's human-generated. You're supplying the wattage to move your vehicle forward. Idaho, for example, has a law called the Idaho Stop, is how it's kind of referred to colloquially, but it means that the stop sign is treated as a yield for bicyclists, so if no one's there, you can go ahead and cruise through. With that said, that's probably the number one complaint I get from people, because they see bikes, he didn't stop, or they're getting away with something that I can't do myself. I guess my comeback to that is, the old momentum thing, and you're, as a bicyclist, if you do slam into somebody, you're probably going to hurt yourself a lot more than you would their car. In terms of bikes not paying their fair share, I mean, I would add that I know of very few bicyclists who don't also own a car and pay a registration fee You know, and we're avoiding paying the gas tax. So maybe that's the one way you look at it. But I think that's been an issue for Wisconsin for a long time going forward. But bicyclists, you know, I mean, we've got a long reputation in this state going back even to the 19th century of bikes kind of fighting for their share of the road. They used to fight it out with a horse and buggy, and now they may be fighting it more out with the pickup truck drivers.
Talking with Mike Ivey right now. He's a journalist and a radio host, and he wrote a piece for Madison Magazine looking at the recent death of a bicyclist in Dane County who was struck and killed by a truck, and looking at how that has reignited some of this debate about a vulnerable user's law and the relationship between cars and bicyclists on the road. And Mike, we have a comment here from Vicky on Facebook who says, I think that cyclists need to follow the rules of the road more. I'm actually shocked on the rare occasions when I see someone signal or stop at a stop sign. More often, she says, I see them riding two or three across on hilly or curvy roads with no shoulders and whipping through stop signs. So one perspective there, and Vicky's not the only one to sort of get at this, but what would you say to her?
Well, I would point out that by law, Wisconsin bicyclists are allowed to ride two abreast. If you look at the statutes. In fact, this law was passed under Governor Tommy Thompson, and it was had the support of the motorcycle community, who also wanted to be able to ride two abreast on the road. I do hear that a lot. People will come by, there'll be cyclists going side by side. Single file! I get that call a lot from people. But if you look at the state statutes, you are allowed to ride two abreast. With that said, I think Vicky makes a point about having some common courtesy out there. If you're in a group or what I would call a peloton, a pack of cyclists, if you watch some of the racing. But there's lots of groups of people out there. And if you see a car stuck behind you, I mean, I think it would make sense to try and pull to the side. I'm constantly telling my biking buddies to car back, and then we try and pull over to the side. The stop sign thing, I don't know if there's any way to really solve that. I think, again, they're getting away with something. I don't think it's a case where cyclists are blowing through a stop sign and getting hit by a car. Personally, I always try and make eye contact with the driver, use a lot of hand signals. If I come to a stop sign and I see someone waiting at a four-way, I try and wave them through and get them to keep moving. I'm not going to defend the actions of every bicyclist. However, I see people going the wrong way on streets, riding down the sidewalks when it's busy, blowing through stoplights, which is probably never really a good idea either.
Let's take a caller here. We've got John on the line in Shawano. John, hi.
Oh, hi, guys. Great topic, of course. My good old Trek 1220 1990s road bike is in my garage. I don't ride it as much as I should anymore. I'm 50. But anyway, not an excuse, huh? Anyway, but I rode years and years in Milwaukee, graduated high school in 1984, I would drive very, very fast going through certain neighborhoods and do the nonstop at red lights and whatnot, like you were talking about. Now I'm living up in rural Wisconsin for many years, but with lots of Amish, and I have almost, you know, crested a hill and taken out a buggy just driving a car.
John, thank you so much for those comments there as a bicyclist and as a driver where you're driving with horses and buggies in the picture.
I might add that John makes a point. The vulnerable users law would also apply to horse and buggy drivers. So it's people who are basically using the public roadway and are not a motorized vehicle. They would get added protections under this vulnerable users law.
Mike Ivey stays with us right now, talking about some tensions that can occur between cars and other motorized vehicles and bicycles who share the road, looking at the conversation around this and a possible vulnerable users law after a recent death of a bicyclist in Dane County who was struck and killed by a truck. And we want to hear from you on this. If you're a cyclist, how do you think that relations on the road between cars and bikes, how is it going right now? Mike says he thinks it's gotten better over the years. Do you share that feeling? Do you feel safe on the road if you're a cyclist? And do you think we need a vulnerable users law to protect cyclists and other vulnerable users as, for instance, buggies with horses and the Amish? And do cyclists need to pay more for the roads that they ride on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back with this conversation after a short break here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our discussion now with Mike Ivey, talking about the conversation that's come up after the recent death of a bicyclist in Dane County who was struck and killed by a truck near the town of Oregon. He was a husband and a father, and the driver in that case will be faced with criminal charges because he left the scene. And looking at what that that debate is like now between cars and bikes, and also looking at the prospect of a vulnerable users law. And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you feel safe as a cyclist? Do you feel that there is a good back and forth, a good sharing of the road between cars and bicyclists right now? What is your experience? And what do you think about this possible law? Call 800-642-1234. And we'll take our another caller now. John is with us in Decorah. John, hi. John, you there?
Hopefully I'm coming out into some more receptive area here. How's that? A little bit better?
There, we got you. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, no, I haven't ridden my bike this year, I don't think at all, but I have been a biker in the past and biked to work, and I fully realize the danger that you feel when you're on a small, I mean, Wisconsin is great in contrast to Iowa because most of your backcountry roads and stuff are paved, but so few of our roads have a lane for bicycles. They've basically evolved to serve car, truck, and, you know, I guess to a lesser extent, but equally important, farm machinery and stuff like that. And you do feel, so vulnerable when you're riding. You want to be on the pavement, like I'm on a road right now where I'm pulling over. But it just goes right to grass and then a steep ditch, and so there's really not room for bikes. And it's nothing to do with, I mean, I was telling your screener that I try to tell myself, look, all I have to do is hope that I can see all bicyclists, because all I have to do is press on my brake pedal where they're just...
Right. Thank you, John. And John, getting at the infrastructure itself, it's evolved to, he says, favor cars. What do you think about that, Mike?
Well, I mean, roads were paved for automobile traffic, after the 20s and 30s. But I think we've come a long way in terms of trying to accommodate bikes as well. The incredible growth of the off-road path has been great, and I think has introduced whole groups of people to bicycling that otherwise wouldn't ride, because it is kind of scary out there with the cars. And also, Wisconsin's Department of Transportation, I think, for the most part, has been pretty good in terms of adding lanes, and there's different communities. It varies community by community.
And John, thanks a lot for that. And let's go next to Paul joining us in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. Would like to...
Oh, no. Let's see. I think you might have been talking about pedestrians. Where do pedestrians fit into the picture, Mike? Do they have the right-of-way when it comes to bikes? And how do bikes handle that?
I think pedestrians should always have the right-of-way, period. Cyclists, I think it's scary when you're walking and some guy comes bombing up behind you on his bike and goes shooting around you. I also saw in here there's a question about electric bikes on the bike paths, and I think that's going to be an emerging issue. Dave Chazovich has talked about that.
What's the issue there?
Well, right now, electric bikes are not permitted on the off-road bike trails. And electric bikes are not, it's not so much a motorcycle, but they have an assist. It helps you go up the hills. And I think as the population continues to age and more people want to get out there too, they're going to have to figure out some way to accommodate the electric bike user as well. But, you know, bottom line, I think pedestrians should always have the right of way. Because if you hit a pedestrian with your bike, you both can get messed up.
And Mike, let's go back to the vulnerable users law you talked about. I know it's been stalled. Where is it right now? What's the status?
Well, I think there's quite a bit of enthusiasm that they were going to get it through, and sort of a watered down version of it did pass and was signed by the governor, but that only called for more education. And from what I understood, it was all set to pass in the last session, but there were a couple of Republicans who weren't comfortable with it, and the Speaker was reluctant to move something forward unless it had complete support from everybody. I think the Bike Fed's going to probably lobby again and try and get it to move forward. I know they were trying to enlist the support of the motorcycle community because this could apply to them as well. Same thing with a motorcycle. I mean, if you get hit, it's hard to really charge somebody with a crime. But there's been some reluctance on the side of the motorcycle people, I think, to get on board with it.
Got another caller here. We've got Michael with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Howdy.
What did you want to share, Mike?
Yes. Number one, I think bikes should be licensed if they're going to be sharing the public road. And number two is I see a lot of bikes up by where I am on Brown Deer and Lake Drive, just probably literally tens and tens and tens and tens going through the stop sign all the time up there. So if you're going to be on the road, then you should be obeying the signs.
All right, Michael, thank you for that. And Mike.
Yeah, by law, you're supposed to stop at the stop signs. But again, I point out that most cyclists, if the coast is clear, it's a real loss of momentum to try and stop and come to a stop. Other states have tried to pass laws that would make it more of a yield. In terms of paying their fair share, bicyclists, as I pointed out before, most bicyclists do own cars and pay that registration fee. I might add that it's not free to ride on the state bike trails. You're required to buy a $25 bike pass. And I think that purchase of that bike path has somewhat come to replace the license that we all used to get. I remember as a kid, you'd get a metal license plate that would hang off the back of your seat and go down every year and get registered. I'm not sure that many people do register their bikes anymore.
Mike, you know, if you are a cyclist and you're out on the road, maybe one of these country roads in the Driftless area that dips and winds.
The kind we all like to ride on.
Right, those beautiful roads. What do you recommend for both for drivers and for cyclists about
staying
safe?
One thing I think that I've seen come around in the last few years for bicyclists is that blinking red light that a lot of people have in their bikes now with the LED light with the battery lasts forever.
Even during the day?
Yeah, because I've noticed even riding with my buddies, when I see that flashing red light back there, it's just that extra split second, you know, that you can pick somebody up. So I suggest that. I think wear bright colored jerseys. That always helps. You know, people laugh at the middle-ager in the tights and the goofy looking shirt. But partly a bright colored shirt does help give you a little more visibility. In terms of automobile cars, you just got to be aware of what's out there. I think rural drivers have gotten used to sort of looking for deer, you know, leaping out at dusk or dawn. You need to have that same sort of awareness about the bicyclists, because the bicyclists are not going to disappear. And you do need, by law, you are supposed to give people minimum 3 feet of passage. And, you know, bikes are supposed to ride as far to the right as practicable. That's the way the laws are really written. So maybe some more education on both ends would be helpful.
Does that mean in the gravel? That's something I've been confused about as a cyclist. So if I'm on the pavement and a car comes, should I be in the gravel?
No. You're never supposed to ride in the gravel. In fact, you've got, you have a right to that road. In fact, I mean, cars aren't going to hear this, but you have a right to ride as far over to the center line as you want. I mean, legally, that's the legal law. The law says that not practicable. That's probably not that practicable, and you're going to get honked at. Or you may feel more dangerous out there. I always feel a little safer to the side.
Cars can get around you.
Yeah,
a little
but
more
I, you
easily.
Know, I'm one of these hard cars. I've been out there. I know. I'm riding with my middle school age son now, and he's kind of getting used to riding in traffic. And we live in downtown Madison, and it's scary out there for a little guy. So
we'll leave it there, Mike. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today and reporting on this.
Always
with us.
Happy to be here.
That was Mike Ivey. He is a longtime journalist, current talk radio show host, freelance writer. Also, as you hear there, he's an avid cyclist, and he wrote about the recent death of a Dane County cyclist and the aftermath, especially as it pertains to a vulnerable users law for Madison Magazine. And you can catch that magazine over on the Central Time Facebook page. Share your thoughts while you're there. We'd love to hear what you have to say about this. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.